From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. The global elite later on out to take advantage of you. Here's what's happening. Well, sorry, soda lovers, even diet drinks can make you heavy. That's the word from authors of two new studies presented at a meeting of the American Diabetes Association in San Diego. For one study, researchers at the center followed 474 diet soda drinkers aged 65 to 74 for almost 10 years. They found that diet soda drinkers' wastes grew 70% more than non-drinkers. Specifically, drinking two or more diet sodas a day busted belt sizes five times more than people who avoided the stuff entirely. And just how does the diet soda make you fat? The other study may hold the answer to that. In it, researchers divided mice into two groups, one of which ate food laced with the sweetener aspartame. After 3 months, the mice eating aspartame, chow, had higher blood sugar levels than the mice eating normal food. Dr. Betty Martini, spending years investigating the dangers of some of these things, she's on with us right now. Betty, you have been saying on this program for years about the dangers of aspartame, and here we go in a couple studies that now beginning to prove that stuff's not good for you.
Yes, and I'll tell you, George, we've known this for 30 years, and it's even in the congressional record where it says that aspartame makes you crave carbohydrates so that you gain weight. It has always been known, and the thing of it is it also can precipitate diabetes and cause it simulates diabetic retinopathy and neuropathy, and it causes diabetics to go into convulsions. It interacts with insulin. So it's caused two epidemics, epidemic of diabetes and the epidemic of obesity.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I want to thank you for continuing to tell our listeners, Betty, about the dangers of aspartame. Let's talk a little bit about this study now. That, you know, people think, okay, we're going to drink diet soda, or I'm going to eat this, you know, it's low calorie, and it might have this aspartame in it. They're going to gain weight even more.
Well, of course. Of course. In fact, we have a saying, if it says diet, don't buy it.
It's a good point.
Yes. And there's been so many studies. Sharon Fowler did one at the University of Texas some years ago, 2005. They used 8 years worth of data, an epidemiological study, which linked, again, the obesity to diet drinks. And there's been several studies, study after study after study. And the last study showed that that heart attacks and strokes were linked to diet drinks. And we've known this all these years as well. Nothing is being done about it.
I think a smart soda company will start putting in things like Just for Sugar and these natural sweeteners instead of this other stuff.
Well, I'll tell you something. The Just Like Sugar company has invented something to replace fructose. But the good news is, and it's so nice to have good news, is that they've come out now and marketed this week something called Fiber Up. And the reason it's such good news is they have programs for children. You know, aspartame's been causing all the ADD, ADHD, and all these psychological problems. And so now they have something that's made out of organic fruits. Even the container is biodegradable and is made out of organic corn, not GMO, but organic corn. And so it's an incredible product. And on top of that, next week they market hot chocolate. Now, I've been tasting that, and it's just like drinking a candy bar. I had given up hot chocolate because there's so many chemicals in most of the products, and there's only four in hot chocolate, and one of them is the dark chocolate, of course, and vanilla bean. So everybody's just delighted because it's going back to food.
Well, bottom line for all this, Betty, read the labels, folks, when you get something, whatever you're drinking, whatever you're eating, and be smart about it. In Uganda, 22 students and a teacher died after lightning struck their school in the country's Midwest there. 51 students between the ages of 7 and 16 were injured and rushed to the hospital. What a tragedy there. In Colorado, a 28-year-old Colorado man was rescued, dusty but alive, after he was trapped nearly 15 hours inside an air conditioning vent. Inglewood police say they responded to calls for help from the roof of an elementary school where they discovered a man trapped 30 feet down the vent. Firefighters had to cut open the vent just to pull him out. News Corporation, as we've been reporting this week, has finally sold the social media site MySpace. They got $35 million for it. They bought it for $580 million. Whoever did that deal, I don't think he's going to be around much longer. Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee has pardoned the last man executed in that state. It's a little late. An Irish immigrant who was hanged more than 150 years ago following what was believed to be a trial tainted by widespread bigotry against Irish Catholics. John Gordon was convicted of killing a wealthy mill owner and the brother of a U.S. senator. He was hanged in 1845 at the age of 29. But law professors and historians now say the evidence against him was circumstantial, perhaps tainted, against the Irish Catholics at his trial. And listening to the radio, according to a study done in Britain, shows that people are happier and they have higher energy levels than watching TV or browsing just on the internet. So there you go, folks. Keep listening to Coast AM. Up next, David Bloom joins us. Alcohol can be a gas. We're going to talk about your world energy update because it does affect you. You might not think so, but the next time you go to fill up your car and you can't, maybe you'll remember tonight. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. David Bloom is the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture, author, of course, of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He's going to be with us for a couple hours on Coast to Coast. We'll take your phone calls with him next hour as well. David, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Well, always glad to be here, George.
Wait, give us some updates. What's going on in the world of oil, the world of fuel these days?
Gosh, there's so much going on out there. There's so much desperation out there at this point for trying to figure out what to do in the world oil scene, because the latest rises in prices have caused disruptions around the world in all kinds of economic sectors. And basically, we're just seeing lots and lots of activity in both really positive ways around the world and, of course, some really crazy ways as well.
All right. Politicians, industry, ineptitude, they have created what we call the oil slick that is taking away alcohol fuel production incentives in the Senate. What's happening there?
Well, basically, big oil has decided that they're doing a preemptive strike on alcohol fuel before the end of the year when some of the tax incentives were supposed to be renewed. It's been almost an operatic proportions of how the slime has been smeared across our process. We've had a direct attack on the alcohol fuel tax credit. So these are credits given to support locally produced American fuel, which is what alcohol is. And most of the states have mandated that there's at least a 10% addition of alcohol to all the gasoline that's sold, because gasoline is so filthy and alcohol cleans it up. Well, the oil companies have decided that they've had enough of that kind of interference in their world. So led by California Senator Feinstein and an Oklahoma Senator Coburn, Oklahoma being a huge oil state, and of course California is not often known for this, but it's a pretty big oil state too, attacked alcohol fuel credits as being wasteful of taxpayer money. And so when their first attack was completely destroyed in the Senate, basically nobody in the Senate agreed with them. They snuck it onto another bill a day or two later after the press had already announced that the tax credit interference bill by Feinstein and Coburn had been defeated. They slipped it in under another bill, and it got made into law just a week or two ago. So for the first time since the start of the Obama administration, it looks like the president may actually veto a bill because this thing is with one of these political dirty tricks that you can't believe somebody had the brazenness to go ahead and try to produce. But, you know, big oil is on the march.
It sure is on the march. And, you know, not since the Arab oil embargo back in the 70s have I seen the point where we still aren't doing anything, David, for alternative fuel. We keep talking about it, but, you know, here we are, you know, what is it, 36 years later plus, nothing's been done.
Not much. Although, you know, farmers have been out there pushing hard in the face of all this incredible opposition to try to make America energy self-sufficient. So actually, we actually make 10% of our fuel nowadays ourselves from plants by making alcohol. That's no mean feat in the biggest energy-using country in the world to be able to, in the face of the oil company opposition, persist and actually build alcohol plants all over the United States, which are producing our own local fuel. And, you know, this is not the kind of thing that you, can attribute to some kind of fat cat favors in the Congress. I mean, this, you know, these guys have been pushing without much help for over 25 years to get us to where we are today. And the fight is on for the first time ever over these credits, which have survived all kinds of administrations, primarily from attacking it from the Reagan administration through the Bush administration. And, of course, we're having to fight, a really concerted battle just to save something that has saved Americans hundreds of billions of dollars over the last 25 years.
Let's talk a little bit about nuclear power. We saw what happened at Fukushima. Let's also talk about Nebraska that's being surrounded by floodwaters. What point are we going to say enough is enough? Germany has gone on record as saying, you know what, we're going to get out of this business.
Well, you know, I wish it was more encouraging. Germany at least is not going to build any new plants, and they were preparing to do so. In this country, there's been a renewed push after decades now of not building nuclear power plants, just try building them again. Now, Fukushima is one of these stories where it is so covered up and so buried about what's really going on that when you really have the scientific understanding and talk to the scientists on the ground, you got to realize that this thing is nowhere near over. At this point, we are, you know, day by day looking at the potential of having a serious China syndrome happen at these four different reactors. And in reality, there are 20 radioactive cores melting through floors of buildings, not four, because all the radioactive storage of the waste fuel, those are all burning into meltdowns. And if any of these continue on down through the floor of their containment buildings and reach the water table, and like George, they're next to the ocean, the water table's barely below them, the steam explosion from 5,000-degree fuel hitting that water will drive the fuel into the stratosphere, and the United States will be blanketed as if it had been under nuclear attack. Jeez. We're already seeing all across the United States food being contaminated by radiation from Japan. We're also learning some new things about science, about the speed at which tuna travel across the ocean between the North Pacific on the Japan side and the United States side. So radioactive tuna are already being showing up on our shores over here. This is one of these things that every government is trying to cover up at this point because it is terrifying in its complications if the nuclear meltdown in Fukushima continues. Already, I mean, imagine this, folks. If you unload a ship on the east coast of Japan, which is where all the industry is,
sure.
You know, ships get top heavy when you take the cargo off. So the usual thing you have to do is you pump seawater into the bottom of the boat, you know, in the bilge, and that keeps the ship heavy until you can take on more cargo and you flush that water out of the bilge.
Give it some ballast.
That's right. It's ballast. Well, if you do that now in Japan, you have to scrap the ship. because the water off the east coast of Japan is so hot that it would ruin the ship forever if you took on that water. So now what's happening is any of the ship traffic for Japan is going around the back of the island to two small ports, and they're having to use massive truck traffic to try to move stuff on and off these ships. The whole nation of Japan is trying to get its supplies through the equivalent of a straw because, you know, they cannot use their ports any longer. That's how serious this disaster is.
But it could be years before we see the effects of Fukushima.
Oh, well, we're already seeing effects immediately. You know, when it first went off, I took one look at the first report and I said, one, they are lying through their teeth. That was a nuclear explosion I'm looking at. So second of all, I said, you know, I've got about 8 or 9 days before the first stuff reaches the West Coast. So I immediately bought a ticket to go join you in Missouri. Well, I didn't actually meet up with you, George, but I went to Missouri. And the day I left, the iodine reading in the San Francisco water supply was 18,000 times the legal limit, after which the NRC stopped reporting radiation readings on the West Coast.
I want to talk when we come back after the break about ethanol and what's going on in that arena, but what's going on also in Missouri about these E-stations?
Oh, we got great plans in Missouri. You know, we're working with a place in Missouri called Overlook Farms, and it's right there on the Mississippi River, where we just received a grant from the USDA to put in the nation's first E98 alcohol station, or a 98% alcohol fuel supply. You can buy E85 or 85% alcohol at a couple of thousand stations around the country, but this will be the first one that is using pure alcohol at the pump, and we'll be doing all local supply of alcohol for that plant, and it will not be from corn once we get it rolling.
Well, that sounds like it might work, huh?
Well, it's pretty exciting because we are actually solving a problem for the town of 500 that is, you know, Clarksville, which is where we're going to be doing this. They have to clean up their sewage. Their sewage treatment plant's pretty rudimentary, and after a small amount of treatment, it goes into the Mississippi River, as do 1,000 other towns along the Mississippi. And new regulations mean they have to clean up their sewage better before it goes into the river. So we are going to be taking that sewage. We are going to be growing energy crops, in particular cattails, a marsh crop, cleaning the sewage so that the water is darn near as clean as coming out of, a national park before it gets released into the Mississippi. And then take the cattails, which are full of starch, and make alcohol for the people of Clarksville to burn in their cars.
What's going on in the world of David Bloom these days?
Oh, my gosh. I am so busy, George, right now, because, you know, although they you know, are treating us like mushrooms in the United States, the rest of the world has gotten a pretty clear message that with this last oil shock that, you know, the cheap oil or the cheap prices for oil, that's just going to happen in places like the U.S., but not where they live. So, for instance, I was in Indonesia back earlier in the year, and gasoline was already $8 to $9 a gallon there, when in the United States, you know, it was well below $4. We were working in Indonesia at a five-star eco resort called Nihiwatu, where we are going to be providing all the energy for that resort with alcohol fuel. I mean, a lot of us think alcohol is all about running cars. And yeah, you can really do that. But alcohol can also make electricity. And this resort, which is currently using diesel fuel, as many places in the world do to make electricity, you know, they're paying over 50 cents a kilowatt. Now, last time you looked at your electric bill, you were probably complaining about 12 cents a kilowatt here. With alcohol, we can get the price down using alcohol in these generators instead of diesel fuel. We can get the price down to below 10 cents a kilowatt. So here's an eco resort that will, instead of using fossil fuel at a high price, will cheaply be producing their energy from alcohol produced from farmers locally on the Balinese island. This resort is located in a place called Sumba.
All right, that sounds good. David, stay with us. Let's talk about ethanol when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. And our special guest for the first couple hours with our split show, David Bloom, as we talk about your energy. We'll talk about ethanol when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Let's go back a little bit, David Bloom. Tell us how you got interested in ethanol, and then give us an update on alcohol can be a gas. I remember when you were first on with me many years ago, that book went through the roof. So how'd you get started in all this?
Well, I got started on this a zillion years ago back in college, where I was an ecology student at the time. And, you know, basically I had a biological professor who was deciding, since it was his last year of teaching, to start lying to the students. He figured there was nobody could touch him at that point, so he decided to make sure that we were all paying attention. And his technique for doing that was, if you could catch him in a lie, he'd take you out for a lunch. So I was angling for my free burrito.
You wanted that, yeah.
Yes. And we had a bottle of beer fermenting on the table, and he just kind of offhandedly turned to the class and said, that stuff, it even run your car, turns back to the board. And I just figured I had my burrito coming. So I jumped up in the back of the room and said, you're a liar. And Doc Sweeney turned around and just said two words. He said, prove it. Well, he just called me out in front of my whole class. So what could I do? So I go to the library, and I figure this is a piece of cake. There's never been any fuel other than gasoline. And boy, was I wrong. I felt literally a three-foot-tall stack of books that had an incredible history of alcohol as a fuel before gasoline was ever invented. And I was just stunned. It was like this whole secret history that no one knew anything about, and I had just kind of stumbled onto it. It was an open secret. So that really hooked me at the time, because everything about alcohol seemed to be so much better than gasoline. And as I dug into it, I discovered that that was true, and that the whole story of how we ended up with oil was just one of political intrigue and nothing about technological advance or it being a better thing to use.
When I was in Los Angeles at my favorite little Greek restaurant, the Great Greek out there, a guy comes in, sits down next to me, and begins to start telling me about Brown's Gas and how he was involved in that engineer who since died in its development. Do you know much about that?
You know, I've been looking into that stuff lately because, you know, there's some interesting effects of things that we don't understand as well as we should. You know, things about how gases expand, for instance, or in the case of Brown's Gas, a peculiar, apparently subatomic phenomena about how that gas is produced. And it's one of those things that I'm interested in finding out more about, because it has the potential to be the first practical use of hydrogen I've ever heard of, because most all other hydrogen schemes that I've looked into don't impress me very much. But I'm going to be doing more investigation into that one myself.
Would you make a report back to us, David, on what you discover and what you think?
Oh, I'll be happy to do that. I have some top physicists I'm working with nowadays from Quantum Green Energy. And we're doing some joint projects around the world, and these guys are doing stuff, you know, collaboratively with us around alcohol. And some of the stuff that they have pulled off is, you know, quite revolutionary. And you'll be hearing more about the stuff we're doing together with them in the future.
What's new in the world of ethanol these days?
Well, gosh, there's all kinds of stuff going on. And I think the big thing that's different in the world today is the pushback you hear about alcohol in the United States has changed tempo from food versus fuel, which, you know, you and I have destroyed on this show several times, that whole myth that alcohol has anything to do with a so-called shortage of food in a world awash in food. And of course, you know, claims that alcohol causes the price of food to go up, which turns out to be the opposite of the truth. You know, these propaganda stories have been failing right and left. The Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN, you know, has come out saying, oh, no, none of these myths are true. The World Bank has come out with a study saying, oh, no, there's no such thing as food versus fuel. That's completely a fabrication. universities around the world, took them a couple of years to study it, have all, you know, come back around to the point of view you and I made 2 years ago, which said that the only thing that's causing the price of food to go up is the price of oil, and that every operation used in growing food and packing food and cooking food and shipping food is based on oil. And if you can reduce the price of all those sources of energy, the price of food would go down. And so we are getting tremendous international attention from people who the issue of food is actually important, unlike the United States, where we take our food and primarily feed it to cattle. I mean, that's where corn goes. 90% of it goes for cattle feed.
You know, and a lot of people, David, don't know that. They think we eat it, we pick up the old corn on the cob in a store. Most of it does go to feed the animals, to fatten them up.
Well, that's right, because, you know, it's a really good source of protein and fat. But most of corn is starch. In fact, 70% of the corn kernel is starch, and cattle can't digest it. So that's why when you feed 10 pounds of corn to a cow, you only get 1 pound of meat, but you get 9 pounds of manure, you know, and that's mostly starch going to waste. Now, with alcohol production, or for that matter, high fructose corn syrup production, the starch is removed first, and all the protein and fat and good stuff in the grain is still there, left over in something called distiller's grains. So the press, not being very savvy to agriculture in general, I mean, most people in the United States are not, you know, get told that 25% of our corn is being diverted to alcohol fuel. Well, you can lie by telling the truth, because that is true. 25% of our corn, instead of going direct to the cattle feedlot, goes first to an alcohol plant. But that story makes it sound as if the corn is destroyed when you make the alcohol. And the truth of the matter is you get the alcohol, but you also get the distiller's grains, the concentrated good nutrition that's left over at the end. It still looks like corn, but it doesn't have the starch anymore. So when you feed that to cattle, instead of the original corn, you actually get a little more meat or milk than you do from the whole corn, because the starch actually gets in the way of cattle digesting all that good protein. But, you know, here's something we're about to do, George, that's going to really put the oil companies in a tizzy, because we're going to destroy that image. What we have now done is made an agreement with a group of cooperative farmers in Iowa, and they're going to provide us with not just the alcohol, but the distiller's grains that's left over. We are going to ship that to a country in Africa where people are hungry, and we're going to supply the alcohol and the distiller's grains for people to eat. The Overlook Farm folks in Missouri are going to work up wonderful recipes to use for this stuff, and the people in Ethiopia or Gabon, we have two places we're going to do this, are going to be able to make really good quality food from the distiller's grains and cook it over alcohol stoves. Now, so the American farmer will be helping alleviate world hunger and deforestation by sending both alcohol and good quality protein to people in other countries rather than waste it by feeding it to cattle and having it turn into manure. And we're going to put a spike in the coffin of this whole argument of food versus fuel, because in this way, we are going to be showing people that the American farmer can feed the world and fuel the world.
You told us once about how people can create and make their own ethanol, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Want to go through that again?
Well, sure. You know, basically, we're talking about moonshining here, folks. I mean, this is a 2000...
Legal moonshining, right?
Well, yeah, except that you need to know that the term moonshine, you know, we Americans here have a tradition of resistance, you know, to being told what to do. And the term moonshine comes from prior to our Constitution being signed, when George Washington was trying to collect a war tax on alcohol from the farmers in Pennsylvania. And people, you know, rose up against this tax. It was in our history books called the Whiskey Rebellion, and basically ended the open making of alcohol without a license, so guys had to do it at night out in the forest by the light of the moon and became known as moonshiner. So you're right, George. It is legal now to make alcohol since the work I and a couple of others did in the 1980s to generate a free permit from the federal government for us to make our own alcohol up to 5,000 gallons a year on the free permit, which is actually included in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, so you don't have to bury through government bureaucracy to find that permit.
Well, that's the important thing, too. You have to do that. Now, what about the safety? What if do you have to put this outside? Can you put it in a garage? And if you do, is that dangerous? How do you get around that?
Well, you know, I have a lot of discussions with fire marshals and stuff about that because they go, oh, my God, you're going to put a fuel in, you know, somewhere around where you live, you know, and of course, putting cans of gasoline in your garage. In fact, during one of the 1980s gas crises, people were storing gasoline in garbage cans in their garages because, you know, we were rationed for gasoline back in the early 80s and people were desperate. And of course, some spectacular explosions happened when, you know, the gasoline vapors escaped the garbage can and found the water heater, you know. But alcohol, well, you know, you can have a lot of cases of glass bottles full of, you know, moonshine or a lot vodka in your house without any, explosive effects. I mean, when was the last time you were at a bar, well, outside of California, where people are smoking and drinking, and, you know, that 1,200-degree cigarette ignited the martini of the guy next to you?
I mean, I've never seen that happen yet.
Never seen that happen. So basically, alcohol is a lot safer than gasoline. But yes, if you're going to store a quantity of it, it should be in a proper, you know, container outdoors, just like your fuel oil tank, for instance. That is an appropriate container for storing alcohol before you pump it into your car. So yes, you know, good safety practices are important, but let's remember what we're talking about here. It is alcohol and not gasoline, which is, quite a bit safer. And of course, if there's a fire, alcohol can be put out with water, where gasoline is only spread by water. So, that's one of the reasons why alcohol is used, at races, you know, car races, because alcohol is, a much safer fuel to be around. And, you know, one of the secret killers in this world has to do with cooking indoors. Now you think, well, wait a minute, I cook indoors all the time. What's the problem there? Well, half of the world cooks indoors with either wood or kerosene. And basically, this is the cause of death of over 2 million, primarily women a year, and children who cook in smoky indoor environments and are breathing toxic smoke from kerosene, which is a common cooking fuel indoors, or wood, which, although romantic, is wood smoke is not something you should breathe. So we're talking tremendous numbers of kids that have been burned by exploding or spilling kerosene fires in the home, and, of course, the lung and eye disease problems from smoke is just legendary in the third world. So we're talking about 3 billion people who eat their meals every night with mom standing there over a pot over a wood fire indoors choking on the smoke. You know, this is such a big problem that our Vice President Hillary Clinton experienced this inadvertently when she was on a fact-finding trip in Africa.
Hold on. When did she become Vice President? Am I missing something?
That's a little slip. Secretary of State.
There you go.
She was Vice President under Bill Clinton. Oh, no, that was Gorsuch. Let's see.
Good try.
Anyway, so recently Hillary experienced this herself and was so appalled by the level of disease that women were experiencing around the world that she has teamed up with an organization that we're part of, the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves, to try to do something about the problem. And there's a number of approaches being taken. One of them is to use better wood stoves. But, you know, if you're trying to stop deforestation and the smoke problems from burning wood, well, you should probably stop burning wood. And so we are working with a group, Project Gaia, that is now supplying alcohol stoves, much like the stoves people cooked on 100 years ago in the Midwest, and around the world in boats for the last 100 years, That's a super clean way of cooking your food. No toxic emissions at all. Alcohol burns with a very clean flame and can be used indoors with no ill health effects. And it's cheaper. It's cheaper than wood. It's cheaper than charcoal, and it's way cheaper than kerosene. And so basically, you know, the Global Alliance is now trying to help people around the world stop cooking over these fields for two reasons. One is health, but the other is deforestation. It turns out that those lumberjacks are not the destroyers of the forest that we attribute deforestation to. It's people who just want to cook their food. And most of the deforestation in the world is for cooking fuel, not for timber. So what's eating up the forests of the world are human termites cutting trees up into little bits and cooking their meals. And it's not safe. It's not safe for a lot of reasons, George, because, you know, people, when they use up all the wood right around where they live, have to go farther to get that wood. Sure. And they go farther and farther depending on what the population is. So you've got people walking 6 hours one way to get a load of wood to carry back 6 hours to cook their food for a week. And if these people are women in a poor country, you can imagine just how hazardous it is to be walking on a road 6 hours to get wood and come back home by yourself. The you know, chance of sexual violence against these women is extremely high. And so it's one of those ecological things. You start having problems with cooking fuel, and all of a sudden you have to go farther to get it. And now you have a social problem where you had an ecological problem to start with, the shortage of wood in your community because you've burned it all. Well, we reverse all this with alcohol fuel. I know this is a long story, George, but this is probably more important to people in the world than making alcohol for cars, because basically we're talking half the population of the world needs to cook. And so in your village, if you go ahead and grow cassava, which is a starchy root, or you grow sugarcane, or you grow any number of other crops that you can do on a village basis to make energy for your village. Now people have jobs. People have a way to use farm products. So farmers have market for, you know, what they grow, and people are gainfully employed making fuel for each other in their village. It's a great way to stop the problem of deforestation worldwide. And so we are getting huge recognition from the UN and also from countries around the world that want to see this stop. So we've been recently in Central American countries. We've been in Peru, where we're part of a conference there that just amazed people from around the world that you could really totally get away from wood as a cooking fuel. We'll be going to several countries in Africa in the next month or so. And today we just got noticed that we'll be going to Mongolia and Bhutan, in addition to, of course, the places I mentioned earlier, like Indonesia, because this is a worldwide problem, and it's something we can do something about on the local level. And this is no different than little old Clarksville on the Mississippi making fuel for its town, for its cars, because they don't have a gas station within 10 miles of where they live. People have to drive 10 miles to get gas.
Well, you eat, sleep, and live this, don't you?
It's important. Well, you know, you get really good at something, so it may seem like that. There's a lot of other things I do too, George, but this one is at the heart of the beast. You know, the everything in this world is made of energy, labor, and capital. So energy is part of everything we do. So yes, eat, sleep, and drink. We need alcohol for all those things. We want to heat our homes. We can, you know, so we can sleep well at night. We can use that in our fuel oil burners. If we want to drink, well, I won't talk about drinking and alcohol, but how about how if we have to pump the water to our town, you know, if we're living in Ecuador, we can use alcohol-powered pumps to be able to afford to pump the water up to where we are because diesel is too expensive.
Okay, but when we come back in just a moment with David Bloom, alcohol can be a gas. We'll take your phone calls next hour with our split show. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back.